Center Collective is based in Portland, Oregon. They are seven individuals who are collectively committed to create radical communities of care, networks of support, and movements based on relationship building. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we will talk with the members of Dicenter Collective about their beginnings, their workshops, their ideas for radical caregiving, and more. Stay tuned. We begin by asking all the members of Dicenter Collective to talk about how they came to work together.
I'm Amelia, and what brought me to Dicentra. I have had a mental illness for most of my life, and I've also been an activist and organizer doing stuff, started out doing anti-globalization work. And I moved to Portland several years ago in order to, one, move out of the South and the horrible mental health resources that they have there, and move to what I considered was the promised land of mental health resources, i.e. the West Coast, and started doing some work on myself and organizing and realizing that there wasn't this distance between organizing, doing work on myself that I had perceived in the past. And worked in a lot of different organizations and just saw other folks around me struggling with similar issues of burnout and dealing with stress and how to communicate their emotions and what was going on with them and their past. And so I just really was interested in having more conversations with the folks I was organizing with. And then as I was doing that, ran into Kevin at the grassroots media camp, and we kind of started having this dialogue, and then a group of us that are, well, everyone that's here in this room basically, came together and started having the conversations and kind of forming the beginning of the collective. So for me, it was really based in kind of the organizing work that I was doing and really looking at practical skills, specifically around communication and processing, doing emotional processing work.
My name is Claire, and I also have been doing organizing around kind of care and support issues for a while. I've done organizing around mental health stuff and also being a support to people in different situations. And I also, for my day job, do social worky stuff. And more recently, I kind of connected with the people of Dicentra because Meredith, another of our members of the collective, and I put out a zine on chronic pain. I have chronic pain, and we felt like there needed to be more information about it out there. And Kevin got in touch with us through that, and we started talking a little bit about some of the stuff Amelia mentioned, just feeling like there's not enough dialogue around issues of care and support, and that they don't take enough of a central role in our conversations as activists.
Okay, I'm Meredith, and Claire pretty much told my story too. I have a back injury and chronic pain, and I worked with Claire on a zine called When Language Runs Dry. It's a chronic pain zine. And through putting that out, we met a bunch of people sort of writing and working on the same issues around health and support. And we met Kevin and started coming to these meetings, which ended up becoming the collective. And that's how I got involved.
And I'm Lydia. And I guess it's a little bit hard for me to talk about how I came to be interested in the subject of care, because it seems like it's just totally central in almost all of the work that I've done up until this point. I was the co-founder of a prison abolition and prisoner support organization, and mental health issues came up weekly at meetings and almost every day in my exchanges with prisoners. So that's one component of how I came to be passionate about care issues. But I'm also a community and clinical herbalist, and I'm currently a student in the healthcare field. And so, I mean, clearly caregiving and issues around care and caregiving are central to that. And as I'm kind of maneuvering my way through the healthcare world and trying to figure out how to make little tiny radical shifts in that, it's a central part of what I consider to be wellness every day when I'm thinking about it and when I'm working on these things is to think about holistic health. And that's kind of central to caregiving in the way that Dicentra is looking at it, because we're looking at both the physical and mental health of not only individuals, but also of the community. So that's how I came to be involved.
I think the way I came to this is similar to how all the other collective members came to this as well, and it comes through our stories. And I think that's where our work is based, which is actually quite unique for most radical movements. My story is that about a year and a half, 2 years ago, my partner became ill, and I ended up caring for her for 3 months before she passed, pretty intensively. And in that process of her illness, I saw the radical community, the DIY punk community, and other elements and other communities around her kind of peel away. And after she passed, and unfortunately I was there when she died, the inability for me to function as a member of my community, but also as an individual or as a person in this like horrible sense of grief, resulted in people peeling away from me too. So I said to myself, what are these radical communities doing, and what are communities in general doing if we can't care for each other when we're sick and when we're dying and when those we've loved have passed on? So once I was able to kind of come out of those moments of grief, I thought this was an important issue to address, and kind of met other folks through care work that they were doing that was very independent from where I was coming from, and also from the kind of work I was interested in, because mostly I want to write about grief issues because that's what I'm facing, and post-traumatic stress disorder, which I've been diagnosed with. And then around this table, there are folks dealing with mental illness, chronic pain, physical illness, all sorts of other issues. And it seemed kind of appropriate to come together around issues of care, because that's really where we all it's in those moments of care and those stories that we all come together.
I'm Karen, and I got involved with Dicentra through really an organic process of having conversations with everyone that's here today, which isn't always an amazing way to get together with a group of people, is organically connecting through all of the issues you've already heard mentioned. And for me, doing work as a counselor, I've always been skeptical of doing that work with an individual, and always wanted to push that work into the community, but it can be challenging to do that on your own. So professionally, I was always excited about the idea of doing more community events and more more conversations about issues of care and support and communication. And I'm uniquely interested in the issues of like disconnection in all kinds of communities and difficulty communicating about challenging things. And this seemed like a great opportunity to not work in isolation and to work with a bunch of like-minded folks who have a lot of personal and professional experience dealing with these issues in their lives. And so for me, the last two collectives I got involved with, it just happened really organically. Like groups of people got together, started talking and connected and decided, hey, let's do something with this.
I'm Jenna, and I joined the collective a little bit later than everybody else. I had heard about meetings happening between people, and there were discussions happening about topics that I was interested around care and communication. But at the time, I was really absorbed in supporting a friend of mine who was experiencing a physical illness. And so I didn't really feel like I had the space and energy to work on any projects. But I came to an event that Dicentra put on about chronic pain and illness. And I was so impacted by it that was kind of like the last straw for me. And I felt like this is something I needed to be a part of. I felt really connected to it. I felt like it was a space to talk about really hard emotions and hard things and find time, which we often don't find, to talk about things that are hard and ask for support and talk about caregiving. And so that's pretty much why I'm part of Dicentra.
Dicentra is the Latin name for the bleeding heart plant. It's the Latin name for that entire genus. And it's generally considered to be poison, but in very small doses, it can be used as medicine, kind of a calming medicine. And it's interesting because if you think about the difference between poison and medicine, the only difference is usually dosage. So it's a plant that I really like because it kind of exemplifies that. And I also think it has a really, really beautiful name. Don't use the medicinal plant Dicentra at home without the supervision of a trained herbalist. As far as the importance of calling us the Dicentra Collective as opposed to just a collective called Dicentra, I would say that because we're so focused on care and communities of care, it's important to incorporate the word collective into our title because it's an example of how we're working and an example of how we think the world should work.
Can you talk a little bit about how you guys work together and how that parallels or contrasts the work that you do in the public?
This is Jenna. I've thought about this question a lot because I think that it's a constant negotiation. I feel like we're trying to create a lot of space in meetings to talk about how we personally feel about ourselves in the work and each other in the work. It's very nebulous. It's really hard to put a finger on. I mean, we hope that our events reflect like the amount of work that we do and the amount of time we spend engaging with each other and trying to figure out where we are all at and what we are all interested in and making sure all our needs are met in the collective. But I really think that it's a challenge. And I think that we have hard times and we have good times. And I really feel like it's important to be open and honest about that and that it is a constant discussion and a constant negotiation. And so I think I would be lying if I said that our process was smooth and easy and everything was always fine. And I think that it's in that honesty that people connect to us.
Can you talk some about what some of those challenges are and also what some of the ways that things work really well for you guys are?
I can speak from my experience. I think the challenges are that we all have a lot of interests and desires and needs, and we all have different issues that we really feel strongly about. And it's a lot of bending and compromising to each other, a lot of personalities trying to negotiate a big relationship. I feel like that can just be generally challenging to do for any group of people, let alone a group of people that is really excited and inspired to do this work. But I feel like that hard work is what makes it so good. And that's like the positive thing is when we actually do have those challenging conversations with each other and when we do have disagreement and when we do, you know, question ourselves where we're coming from and try to listen to where other people are coming from and figure out a way to kind of like work on that path together. So I think like the conflict is part of the greatness of this group of people. The hope is that we can continue to be honest and open with each other and make our work that much stronger and let people know that it's okay to have hard conversations about things and it's okay to disagree. And that's kind of what organizing is about and what relationships, at least for me, are about.
I would also say that's something we want, a way that we want our organizing to reflect our work, but something that we struggle with is self-care for ourselves, because it's really easy to get wrapped up in the work that we're doing and get kind of overbook ourselves, and we're always struggling with that. I think for myself, and I don't know if other people in the collective feel this way, it's easy for me to kind of check out a little bit sometimes too and recreate that split between my intellectual self and maybe my emotional self within the collective and just be like, I'm organizing right now, so my emotional stuff or my personal life should be set aside. And so I have to kind of consistently remember to reintegrate those two things and that they don't have to be separate. I think something that works really well is that when we are bringing that to the table or when we are talking about that, it feels like a really safe space in our collective to talk about that. And people are always super supportive around everyone meeting their personal needs. If you're like, I'm really sick today, I'm not going to make it to the meeting, nobody's going to be harsh on you or anything like that. So I think we have to keep reapproaching that issue, but that we're really supportive of each other.
So I'm a really practical nuts and bolts person. So something that I think is different in the way that we organize than I've organized in other collectives is that we spend a lot of time before each event talking and talking and talking about what is the event, who do we want to be there, what is our intent in putting on this event, what are the terms that we're using, what do they mean, what terms do we want to use, you know, how do we create a space that is educational but also supportive of people. So for instance, how we brought Jenna into the group is that we actually created this support team role so that at every one of our events, there's Jenna and this last event, we had another person come on that if anyone feels like they need to step out of the event, talk to someone, process, have some sort of issue come up for them, there's someone there that they can talk to. And it also, for us as organizers, means that we don't have to be pulled away necessarily from doing the organizing. That, I think, is something I've never experienced before at an event that I've ever organized. And that came up really organically out of us really thinking strategically around how do we create an event to reflect what we care about and our intents as a collective. And so I think that is unique in itself, really trying to model in the events that we create, kind of like the vision of what we're trying to create, I think, in the community as well.
I think the question that you're getting to there is how Dicentra is different from other collectives. And I think as we all began telling our personal stories, I think that's an important element here to the development of the collective and how the work has functioned. Most other collectives that I've been involved in, I think most collectives and most kind of political organs that exist out there in the radical community come together for either ideological reasons, theoretical reasons, all kinds of organizational a priorities, which personally I found problematic. And here, because folks are coming out of their experience and really connecting with their base stories, allowed us to create a moment within the collective itself and also a moment within our events in which people can then connect with their own stories, which is a different process than connecting or identifying with a political position. And I think the failure of most political organizing in the United States is the fact that it doesn't connect with people's everyday lives. It doesn't connect to their stories. And if you look at strong organizing models that are currently taking place in worker centers, environmental justice projects, and a lot of very similar kind of health-ish processes that are taking place, like, we're certainly not the only folks having this discussion, and we see zines coming out which folks at this table have been involved in. We see these kind of conversations taking place other places. We were constantly getting emails from other places around the region, around the country, of folks interested in this work because it's not taking place in this way. And I think that kind of relationship building as a model for radical organizing is vitally important, because what it does is it opens up the possibility of bringing other folks that wouldn't participate in radical movements in. It brings up the possibility of addressing real issues that take place in our everyday lives. And not even to mention the fact there's a number of issues that the group around this table is not addressing or not dealing with that relates to care, elder care, for instance, which is an issue that our parents and our grandparents' generation is dealing with, and something that we'll eventually have to deal with as well. But the issue of care connects to so many realities and so many different communities in different ways. And the fact that our society doesn't provide even the most basic fundamentals of the question of care is screwed up. It's just not acceptable that our society does not provide even the most basic elements of care. And the fact that radical movements have not addressed that is immensely problematic. This collective not only wants to address those questions, but wants to organize in such ways where most kind of traditional organizing and radical models have not worked. It's focus on the issue, it's focus on the revolution, it's focus on a whole bunch of other things except for those questions, as Claire was saying, of self-care, and Jenna, some other folks were talking about earlier. Are we a closed collective? I guess we haven't discussed if we're a closed collective. I kind of think we are. We are? We are a closed collective? I guess we are. I mean, in the sense that, like, if someone else was to come in and involve themselves in this work, they would have to have that open-mindedness that we're coming from our experiences, and we're coming from varied experiences, that we don't agree necessarily politically or on other issues. So, for instance, we had an event on harm reduction that included Rose City Cop Watch, which is a police monitoring and abolition organization. And I don't remember us taking a poll and seeing if everyone believes in police abolition or prison abolition in the group, but we saw that event as an opportunity to bring those kind of discussions into this fold and to bring harm reduction and content in contact with police and prison abolition movements and in other conversations around care. So it's almost as if we're not uniting around a political idea, but rather a process and understanding there's a process of care that's going to look different in different communities. To go back to the are we a closed collective question, it seemed that when we found someone that was appropriate and was interested in our work in the way that we're doing it, it was appropriate to bring them in. So that very well could happen in the future.
And are there other ways that people can get involved to support your work without being particularly part of the core collective?
The ways people can be involved, I mean, we've definitely received a ton of emails and a ton of people outreaching, asking how they could be involved or wanting information from us. I think based on what Claire was saying about the networking aspect, I think people can get involved by coming to events and connecting with other people and using the energy that they get perhaps from what happens at the events to continue conversations, continue dialogue, and perhaps continue projects. And so one of the main things I think we talked about at the beginning was doing something with that energy that comes out of events and helping people do something with it rather than it just die 30 minutes after you leave an event. And so that's an exciting way people can get involved, is to think of our events that way. And that's one of the reasons why I think we've moved to having a model where we have an event each month and then the next month a follow-up to that event. And hopefully that stimulates and supports organizing and an ongoing dialogue and not just a one-hit kind of one-hit wonder kind of event.
I also just really quick want to add to that, and that is that Dice Center doesn't we're not monopolizing the issue of care. So a lot of times we get people writing in from out of town and they want us to come speak at their events, or they want help on how to do a care workshop. And my response is that you can talk about care too. Care is something that we all in some way know how to do. We all know basic communication skills. We all can learn more. We can always be working on these things. But people are excited to hear about this stuff. People want to be talking about issues of care. If you're interested in working on these things, start talking about it. Start your own collective.
This is Meredith. So our first event was in November at the Red and Black, and it was our first event and also a zine release party reading around the zine that Claire and I did called When Language Runs Dry about chronic pain. We had about 3 people read pieces from the zine, and also Emiko, who does Broken Hipster zine, read from her zine about physical illness. And then we had a workshop at the end just talking about how people can better support their friends and loved ones and family members who are going through chronic pain or physical illness, and also how a person in pain can better ask for support. And it was great.
Chronic pain is defined as pain that persists for more than 6 months. It is often mysterious and goes undiagnosed, but can stem from injury, illness, surgical complications, or can be an inherited condition. Because it is a condition that is invisible, pain often goes without treatment or validation. The chronic pain experience is not just about the physical sensations, but also has serious emotional and social implications. Dicentra Collective members Meredith and Claire published a zine of 7 essays about chronic pain and caregiving in August 2008. This is Claire.
I remember this Brazilian chiropractor practicing in San Francisco once told me, "Latinas are usually not very flexible." He was surprised by my dancer body's ability to move so easily, in spite of the pain and tightness of my muscles. I thought how, when you carry a great many people's histories on your bones, including but not limited to rape, torture, exploitation, which not only happened to you, but your sister and her daughter's friend, and also your land, and you are carrying your future strapped tightly to your chest, sucking its thumb, and you are also carrying your gifts of loving and healing, at times bending over backwards to provide them, well, yes, your tendons and ligaments may have tightened some. When you have worked twice, 3 times as hard to carve out a space in the world, and it probably included evenings and weekends, you are bound to be sore and inflexible. In her book of poetry and pensamientos, Loving in the War Years, queer and Chicana author Shiri Moraga writes, "Sometimes I feel my back will break from the pressure I feel to speak for others." A friend told me once how no wonder I had called the first book I co-edited with Gloria Anzaldúa, This Bridge Called My Back. "You have chronic back trouble," she says. Funny, I never considered this most obvious connection, all along my back giving me constant pain. Moraga is saying her need to voice the story of her people's identity is a great weight she carries, causing real pain to her body. Being a woman, and a woman of color, and a queer woman of color, means experiencing an acute sense of invisibility. And for Moraga and many others, there is a need to speak out against this invisibility. Further, having these identities means carrying the weight of our mutual and often painful history on our backs every day. What ailment more literal than chronic back pain? It is a pain caused by a burden too heavy to be carried without trauma to our spines. Further, it is an ailment as invisible as we are forced to be in this world. It was not until I began to experience more severe back pain that I began to meet so many others like myself, usually women, often queer women or women of color, or both, who suffered this illness themselves. Talking with those I have met, I recognized our common experiences. Like Sheri Moraga, I had a realization about the direct connection between my pain and my identity. I already live in a world in which I have fought to be seen and seen on my own terms. People belonging to groups oppressed by the dominant culture have always been in danger of erasure. Our languages, ways of healing, our food, our stories, all continue to be methodically scratched off the surface of the earth. Yet it is not just our cultures that are threatened with disappearance. The very ways we choose to identify are denied us. In my father's family, we have slowly lost our connection to our Mexican ancestry. My father and his siblings were discouraged from speaking Spanish, both at home by their parents and at school. Familial ties in Mexico were slowly cut, until no one ever crossed the border anymore to visit the aunts and uncles on the other side. As he grew older, my father strove to assimilate with white American culture as best he could, shedding his cultural past in an attempt to find a better future. Some of it cannot be retrieved. Growing up, I always felt the void where my family's history used to be. It was like a cold wind blowing in the emptiness behind me, raising the hairs on my neck. Some of our story had been erased by the hands of hegemony. It has been challenging to assert my existence and identity in the present in spite of what was lost in the past. For so long, I did not even have names by which to call myself, those names that I have now, queer, Chicana, among others. The culture around me was telling me that my experience did not or should not exist, that I am invisible. I carry the trauma of those times I was given this message, and it weighs me down. For myself and for most others, chronic pain has physical causes and is a real illness. It can also be a manifestation of emotional and psychological trauma and a sense of invisibility. It serves to aggravate these problems. Chickasaw poet and novelist Linda Hogan recounts in her memoir how she lost her ability to dream due to fibromyalgia she developed. As an ancient measure of herself, Hogan had always counted on her ability to dream and her ability to connect with the holy through her dreams. Yet she lost this fundamental ability when she developed chronic pain. She writes, "The inner story slipped away from me. Myself was dismantled, unbuilt. My faith in the body and its vitality was lost. And losing faith in the body a person inhabits and has been in good relationship with is frightening. In pain, there is the unmaking of a person, an identity, a world." Hogan's pain reflected a long history of trauma both she and her people had suffered. In a sense, the pain dug this trauma to the surface, worrying it like a person worries a scab until it bleeds, causing a fresh wound. Hogan's pain highlighted her past suffering. At the same time, it caused her new injury by destroying the ways she had formerly stayed connected to her identity and given it voice in the world.
You are listening to Circle A Radio, KBOO, Portland.
This is Meredith.
On bravery. Pain crept into my life so slowly I didn't even need to make room for it. Introducing itself with a tug, it felt at first like nothing more than a pulled muscle in my right leg. Now, as I trace injury back through 8 years of journals, I see that it wasn't until a couple of months later that I started to make anything of the increasing discomfort I was feeling in my back and my leg and sought out the help of a doctor. Back then, I defined myself by the things that I made, my projects, music, and art. I was working a full-time job, playing in bands, and running a show and recording space with friends. I had started sewing and getting involved in crafts and organizing. I felt I existed in what I brought to my community. When pain demanded space and attention, I resisted accommodating it. Sure, I gave injury some of my time by keeping therapy and doctor's appointments, but I never slowed down the way I needed to, and I refused to let it stop me. I felt more protective of my projects than my body and fought against the pain that was making me unproductive. I ignored the discomfort when I could, pressed on with what I felt I needed to get done, and rested in tears and privacy at the end of the day. I told myself I was doing what I needed to do. I was being brave. I grew up in a sunny Southern California suburb, the middle child to a middle-class family. While illness and injury were never a big part of my childhood, I learned early on that, in my family at least, being sick usually meant giving something up. My parents made it clear that if my siblings or I were too sick to go to school, then we were too sick to play or participate in after-school activities that day as well. In my elementary and middle school years, I was devoted to dance and children's theater and would weigh every sore throat, sniffle against missing rehearsal or time in the neighborhood with friends. If I ever did give in to sickness, it usually meant I was actually really ill, resulting in a highly despised visit to the doctor and a round of antibiotics. Strangely, my love for performance has always been coupled with contradictory feelings of hatred for being the center of attention. Detesting how invasive attention can feel, being examined by a doctor was an agony I would choose to avoid if at all possible. I remember some days in the time between school and dinner when, after getting us settled into our homework or TV programs, my mom would tell my siblings and I she was going to go lay down for a bit. I knew then that Excedrin was her preferred brand of headache medicine, and she always kept a few of those chalky white pills in a little tin in her purse. It wasn't until I started having migraine headaches of my own that I was even aware of the name for the kind of pain she was regularly bearing. She never made it known, never complained, never let her pain come between her and her family. Though there was a lot of love in our home, comfort seemed to sometimes fail us. I would think hard before ever calling out to my parents in the middle of the night if I was up with a stomach ache or some similar affliction. On one particular night, the discomfort was bad enough that I shuffled out of my room into the darkness of the house. Standing at the bottom of the stairs in my nightdress, I whisper-yelled tentatively up towards my parents' bedroom door. My mom sleepily navigated her way down the dark steps toward me and simply stated, "Go back to sleep. There's nothing I can do." Bravery, as I'd learned it, meant not being overcome with emotion in the face of pain. No complaining, no public tears, no neediness. Bravery meant not making my situation anyone else's problem. So even though I had friends all around me at shows, potlucks, and groups, I felt isolated in what I was going through. I hated how talking about my back made me feel boring, depressed, and weak, and instead deferred to silence or fakery. The fact that I appeared healthy on the outside shielded me from questions and camouflaged me against the reality of what was happening inside. Denial for bravery's sake was a mode of survival that allowed me to keep my self-image largely unchanged in the face of injury, and I would have kept on that way if not for all of the energy and effort it required. If pain hadn't broken down my ability to concentrate, if it hadn't begun to show on my face and the way that I walked. It was maybe the first clear night so far that spring, and people were out in dense clusters, pouring into the streets between galleries, clutching Dixie cups of red wine from art openings. A group of friends and I had decided to join in on Portland's first Thursday art walk craziness, trekking from Milk Bar to Reading Frenzy and wider off into the newness called the Pearl District, peeking in places along the way. As the night drew on, my walking became more labored and concentrated. I was having trouble keeping up with my friends. Months of injury had gotten me used to being at the back of the pack, but my muscles were tightening up against each step I took, and I was starting to fall behind in earnest. The sidewalks were crowded, and navigating the hurried and the tipsy left me feeling even more slow and vulnerable. A loud group of guys were coming towards me, and I passed carefully between them, accidentally brushing up against one with my bag. Waiting until he was safely past me, the dude I'd made unintentional contact with looked over his shoulder and shouted, "Watch where you're going, hunchback." And I looked down, flushed with the shame of being exposed. Cruel as it may have been, it wasn't his choice of words that dug into me, but rather that my weakness was visible. I was without protection. It is interesting to me that the word patient is both a noun and an adjective, a word that defines a person who is being given medical treatment and simultaneously qualifies them as able to endure waiting or delay without becoming annoyed or upset. To be patient is to persevere calmly when faced with difficulties and to be able to tolerate being hurt, provoked, or annoyed without complaint or loss of temper. For a year, I passed from exam room to exam room, seeing countless doctors, acupuncturists, chiropractors, naturopaths, physical therapists, and imaging specialists. Doctors were all saying the same thing, that the choices I had were to continue treating my injury with conservative care and hope for it to heal, or to schedule surgery. Friends and family gave me advice, Xeroxed medical articles about the spine and sent them in the mail, offered to drive me to appointments. I took a break from work, which led to a longer break, which led to me leaving the job entirely. I felt guilty for needing to spend more and more time in bed, frustrated that no matter what I did, things seemed to stay the same or gradually become worse. I was turning 25 in 6 months' time and would no longer be covered by my father's health insurance, and I was unable to work for my own. I decided that I had given all that I could to conservative treatment options and resigned myself to back surgery.
The second event that we had was focused primarily on harm reduction and intervention. And I feel like right now in my life, harm reduction is one of the things that I'm most passionate about. And this was actually an event that a couple of us had talked about before we even started working with Dicentra. We wanted to start looking at harm reduction as a broader movement than simply just needle exchange or passing out condoms in high schools. We wanted to do harm reduction in everyday life and see how harm reduction was fueling all different types of work. So we gathered together a fellow named Dennis Lumberg from Janus Youth Street Outreach, and he talked about how harm reduction fuels his work in his work with homeless youth. We had folks from the Rose City Cop Watch, and they talked about how harm reduction fuels their work. And then last but not least, and kind of what we had planned as the cornerstone of that event, was we had a friend come up from Eugene who discussed Whitebird and the CAHOOTS program. So the CAHOOTS program is a program in Eugene, and if you dial 911 and there's no imminent violence, you can request CAHOOTS and not utilize the cops, which, at least in my mind, is inherently harm reduction theory working. So that was the second event, and I think it was a huge success. People seemed to really enjoy it.
In preparation for this second event, members of Dicentra Collective were guests on the KBU radio show, Positively Revolting Talk Radio. This is host Ani Haynes and Lydia and Amelia.
This morning we're looking at, and I kind of want to start off with a definition of harm reduction.
All too often people associate harm reduction specifically with needle exchange programs, but harm reduction is really sort of a broader social justice movement, and you can apply it to almost any kind of work that you're doing, specifically if you're providing services in the community. Harm reduction is essentially looking at any harm that is created by a specific activity and trying to limit that harm. So instead of making moralistic judgments or trying to make sweeping alterations in the way society functions, we're instead just trying to limit the harm.
One of the things that I think is really important about that is that at its core is an anti-alienation way of being. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that aspect of harm reduction and how it actually creates a chance to build community as opposed to treat people like they don't belong in community?
A lot of times harm reduction is providing a service, so we're just making small shifts in the way that services are provided, in the way that relationships happen. And the point of all of it is to try to establish communities where there's not as much alienation.
What do you say to people who say that harm reduction is a way of encouraging drug use or promiscuous, I love that word, sexuality?
Whenever I hear that, I get this flashback to this, to some historical stories where harm reduction eventually turned out to be really, really useful. World War I, American soldiers ended up with more STDs than any other soldiers globally, or at least from that particular interaction. And the reason for that was that they completely condoned all sex acts. So we ended up with this, we ended up sending tons and tons of soldiers back to the U.S. with all kinds of STDs. World War II rolls around, and they give every soldier 8 condoms a month. Soldiers came back with many fewer STDs. So when I hear that criticism, I just can't help but think about things that really didn't work in the past.
I think harm reduction is a really realistic approach. You know, it looks at where people are and like, this is where folks are at, and let's help them and support them in a process and realize that sexuality and like learning about sexuality and addiction, all of those are a part of a spectrum and a process, and it recognizes that that's happening rather than being like, okay, you have to be at this end. You know, you have, like, there's this specific thing and you have to be that. My experience with harm reduction is that it just views people as human, like you're talking about, and sees that people are part of a process and that, you know, sometimes it takes time. Most people overnight are not like, today I'm an alcoholic, tomorrow I wake up and I'm clean, it's awesome, you know, and I'm clean for the rest of my life, you know. Most of us with substance abuse problems know that that's just not the reality.
That was an excerpt from Positively Revolting Talk Radio, another KABU program. The full audio of the program is available at kabu.fm. And now, back to our interview with the Dicentra Collective. This is Karen.
Our third event was focused on sexual assault, domestic violence, and safe space policies, and that came out of a direct result of the conversations we began having about safe space policy within our collective. And many of us had discussed these issues prior to joining the collective. I think that was sort of the roots of how some of us got connected, was through another event. Kevin and a bunch of members of another collective he's in, where some groups came out from Philadelphia called Philly's Pissed and Philly Stands Up. I'd been thinking about these issues for a long time, and many of us have been personally impacted by the issues of sexual assault in the community, particularly in activist community. And so we wanted to address these issues.
The following statement was read and distributed at this event on January 8th, and the full text can be found at dicentracollective.org.
The Dicentra Collective is actively seeking to create radical communities of care, and this evening we are applying harm reduction approaches to intimate violence, that is, to sexual assault and domestic violence. Dicentra is seeking to create safer spaces by working towards healing the community from the harm caused by intimate violence. Dicentra's approach to intimate violence and creating safer spaces. Dicentra has examined both traditional and radical models that address intimate violence, as well as our own experiences with them. We have found in all of them things that were quite troubling, as well as inspiring, and created this event, and the one to follow on the 12th of February, to examine our thoughts and those circulating in our communities more closely. These conversations began with the construction of our own safer space policy and our use of the term safer rather than safe, as we understood this as an attempt rather than an absolute. For us, the basis of this policy had to be in healing with an understanding of the support needs of survivors and honoring their self-determination. Part of this healing has to be processes of holding those perpetrating acts of intimate violence accountable in a way that provides for their own ability to address these acts and decreases the harm caused to those around them as well as themselves. Additionally, each member of the collective and the communities that surround us have been impacted by intimate violence. Hence, our common and diverse experiences have led us to this point. As those with these experiences, we want to acknowledge that it can be difficult to discuss intimate violence. Members of Dicentra have observed that too often the voices of survivors are not heard and their process of healing goes unsupported. We also clearly understand that sexual abuse happens within a political context. We live in a highly oppressive society that privileges some while traumatizing others. These sort of systemic abuses don't exist in a vacuum. They affect our daily lives, how we relate to each other, and how we take out our frustration and anger. Many of us haven't learned or are still learning the tools and skills to deal with how this oppression affects us, and unfortunately, many times make unhealthy or harmful choices as how to deal with it. We are particularly inspired by projects that are moving away from the question of survivor credibility toward looking at action steps that the survivor wants taken on a community level, and projects that move beyond the criminal justice system that continues the harm perpetrated by intimate violence.
We are inspired by projects that are prioritizing survivor self-determination and autonomy, as well as providing needed techniques of self-care and counseling to survivors.
We are inspired by initiatives that work with both those who have and are in the process of surviving intimate violence and those who have perpetrated such acts.
We are inspired by the level of interest in Portland and across the planet in developing new approaches and community-wide mechanisms to heal from intimate violence, and the dedication upon the part of many members of our communities to come together to discuss and address experiences that are quite difficult.
We are inspired by radical approaches to intimate violence that are developing from the voices of queer and trans peoples, people of color, the differently abled and bodied, working class, and other oppressed peoples.
We are particularly troubled by accountability processes that continue to demonize perpetrators as others and do not focus on healing the community at large.
We are troubled by organizations and community spaces that have safe space policies, but no mechanisms for addressing how to create safer spaces or to address unsafe situations that may arise.
We are troubled by the crisis model of organizing that reacts to situations as they happen, rather than creating better practices and educational activities that are incorporated into larger radical movement work.
We are hopeful for recent discussions of good consent practices and the possibility of educating our communities around them.
We are hopeful for harm reduction approaches to intimate violence that understand the particular needs, context, and experiences of the particular survivor.
We are hopeful for the engagement with those who have perpetrated acts of intimate violence in ways that don't just hold them accountable, but seek to understand their particular context and experiences as well.
We are hopeful for creating inclusive and participatory spaces that are not limited to activists and members of a particular counterculture and involve the experiences and approaches of many different communities. Again, that was a statement read at the Dicentra Collective's January 8th event on intimate violence and creating safer spaces. This is Karen continuing the discussion.
We really wanted to shift gears, though, in this event and move from the speaker model to having community conversation model. And so we really started this event by talking a little bit about what kind of space we wanted to create, and we then broke into small groups and got people talking about what their experiences were with dealing with these issues, what went well and what didn't go well in their experiences of sexual assault, domestic violence, and safe space policies in the community. People just talked with us and talked with each other about what they'd experienced, and we came back together as a large group and gathered those ideas and thoughts, and wanted to do a follow-up event to see what more we could do with some of those ideas. We also reviewed some community accountability principles from the group CARA in Seattle, Communities Against Rape and Abuse. And we just critiqued and talked about some of those issues of what could possibly happen if you were attempting to hold folks in your community accountable. And we also try and add the component in all of our events of trying to talk about communication and how to support each other with different issues. And we did that again at the sexual assault event. We knew that if we brought up this issue in the community of dealing with sexual assault, domestic violence, etc., that it was not going to be able to be handled in 2 hours. So our follow-up event to that is on Thursday, February 12th at 6 o'clock at In Other Words.
I also think the follow-up model that we're working on right now, or having a follow-up event, also was a reflection of our process and how it's been shifting and changing over time and evolving, and realizing that doing a monthly event covering a different topic, it requires a tremendous amount of work. And not to say that it wasn't possible, but more that it seemed like that the need of having extra time to follow up to discuss the topic outside of 1 2-hour session, coupled with our need to have more space and time to internally talk to each other, as well as have a benefit every now and again or have a movie night, have other types of events that we could do, it just kind of worked out really nicely. And this specific event just seemed really appropriate to have some kind of follow-up.
Each kind of event has ended with this networking session and communication workshop, and I think that's an important aspect to address because that, in addition to the fact that we have a support team at events when dealing with these issues. But I want to address the question first because other folks can speak to that around the difference between our first three events. And I think it certainly has to do with what Jenna just said, but I think it also relates to the fact that each of these kind of experiences and bringing up these kind of conversations around care issues have to be dealt in a different way. So when you're talking about people's experiences with physical illness or chronic pain, it seemed appropriate at the time, and I still think it does, in order to have folks speak about those experiences and having folks read from the zine and other audience participants reflect on their own experiences and speak to them was a very appropriate model for that. And then in our second event, having a more formal presentation from folks that are working in harm reduction seemed appropriate because what we wanted to do is bring that concept out of needle exchange type programs or condom exchange and develop a model for that particular event that allowed that information to be passed on and then discussed. And then in our final event, it's also appropriate, as Karen just said, to have folks be able to express their experiences because a lot of us have had negative experiences in the radical community, in society in general around sexual assault and intimate violence. And expressing that as a first stage allowed folks then to look at the practices that aren't working.
If you haven't made it to the events and you're curious about them, most of the events are up on YouTube. The first two events, I should say, are up on YouTube on the Dicentra channel, which you can get to through www.dicentracollective.org.
Does somebody want to talk about some of the events that are coming up too? What's in the pipeline?
We're doing an event on Tuesday, February 10th with two speakers from New York, one in New York via Italy and another who's a longtime New Yorker. Sylvia Federici and George Kofensis of a collective called Midnight Notes. And for the last 40 years, both of them have been intervening, researching, and acting on questions of current movement composition, the structure and relations of power and capital in our society, and especially issues of care. And since both of them will be traveling through this era, we decided to utilize their visit as a way of intersecting these issues of care, which Sylvia's work is based on, with issues of the current economic crisis, which her partner and companion George Kofensis will be speaking on. So on February 10th at 6 o'clock, in other words, you can come see an event on the current economic crisis and how it intersects and is related to the crisis of care that's taking place.
And then we're having an event on February the 12th, the follow-up event to the sexual assault, domestic violence, and safer space policy. And that's looking like it's going to be really focused so much more on dialogue and small groups.
Is that event open to people that didn't attend the first one?
Yeah, it is open.
Since you have most of your events, in other words, do you know what's happening with them and how that will impact you?
The statement I can make on their behalf is, in other words, as most independent and radical bookstores have gone through rough times with the current economic crisis, among other things, and they needed to raise a substantial amount of money by the end of January and then an additional substantial amount of money in the thousands of dollars by the end of March. And as of today, I can say both thankfully and excitedly that they've raised all that and more. So the support that's come out from, in other words, has been huge. They've drawn from both a national and regional feminist and radical community to pull in donations in order to keep the last nonprofit feminist bookstore in the United States afloat. So they're actually doing quite well, and they're in the process now of, by June, they're looking to have 500 members. In other words, it's been remarkably supportive of us as a organization. They are going to be carrying a number of our recommended zines and book titles to further our work and provide resources in that way to the community. They've hosted us now for three events and will continue to do so. And really without spaces, like in other words, we would have no place to go and we wouldn't have a community to utilize, a community space rather, to utilize for events. To add, it's a very comfortable space, and having a space that many different folks from different communities feel comfortable coming to and can sit at is important, and that's something that we want to maintain by supporting them as they've supported us.
What kind of support are you looking for from the community?
the community has been super supportive of us, not only just our participants that have showed up, but in other words, in Red and Black hosting our first event and hosting a benefit for us. And I think we're generally really excited about the support we've received.
Another way that our work would be supported is for people to have these dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
In their communities, with their friends, if they are going through a hard time. You know, look for resources, learn how to ask for support, or if you see that your friend is having a hard time, find a way to ask them if they need support. And I think that actually is what we actually really want people to do, and what is like key to what we're talking about is like wanting folks to do this work in their lives and have these hard conversations with the folks that they're organizing with, their families, their friends.
I would say that the best way to support us is to talk to each other.
Another piece of what we're doing is trying to gather resources to put together a zine distro. We've started one on Etsy, which is dicentracollective.etsy.com, and you can get to it through our website as well. We're always looking for recommendations of other things to carry, and that's another way you can support us is by buying zines from us.
You've been listening to an interview with the Dicentra Collective on Circle A Radio. For more information about Dicentra, check out their website at dicentracollective.wordpress.com. That's DICENTRACOLLECTIVE. .wordpress.com.
Circle A Radio broadcasts every first and third Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in Hood River. You can listen to other Circle A Radio shows archived on our website at kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. If you'd like to reach us, drop us a line at circlearadio@gmail.com. We love feedback. Thanks for listening.